The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Marilyn Robinson is the author of the novels Gilead, which is the winner of the 2005 Pulitzer Prize, and Housekeeping, which has many, many great claims to fame, but it's one of my all-time favorite novels. When Housekeeping came out, Anatole Broyard wrote in the New York Times, "It's as if, in writing it, she broke through the ordinary human condition with all its dissatisfactions and achieved a kind of transfiguration." In the intervening years until Gilead came out, Ms. Robinson wrote two books of nonfiction, Mother Country, a scathing examination of radioactive pollution in Britain, and The Death of Adam, Essays on Modern Thought, a collection of critical and theological essays. She's taught at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop for the past 19 years, and I really envy those fortunate Iowa students. Gilead is a novel in epistolary form as the Reverend John Ames, an elderly preacher, contemplates his mortality. He writes a letter to his young son on the eve of the civil rights movement, recounting his family's history against the backdrop of 19th century social and political movements. In her new novel, Home, Marilyn Robinson revisits the characters from Gilead because, as she said in an interview, there were characters I still had on my mind. Marilyn Robinson will discuss what else she has on her mind with Michael Silverblatt, genial host, penetrating reader, and the guiding spirit of KCRW's acclaimed radio show, Bookworm. Please welcome Marilyn Robinson and Michael Silverblatt. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Yes, I think so.
Wanted to begin by saying that when Housekeeping first came out, I didn't yet have a radio show, so it wasn't the case that dozens of books came to my doorstep. But in the bookstore, you know, I was too young to know the secret of blurbs. And as I discovered it, you know, I'd get very alerted to who was blurbing who. But I picked up this book, which cover I think is beautiful, and there were blurbs from John Hawkes, Doris Lessing, and Walker Percy, three of my favorite novelists, and who, as far as I knew, were not in communication with one another, and so it wasn't a team effort. So I bought the book, you know, and now, you know, this is a celebrated book, but then when it came out, it was kind of a cherished secret. It didn't burst onto the scene. It grew roots and fans and people who'd murmur about it to one another. I think I spent the first month I had it reading its opening paragraph to friends on the phone because, you know, like the rest of her work, it's so beautiful. The author, French author Jules Renard, says in one of his journals that no matter how much care you take to write as little as possible, there will always be those who have not read everything you've written. One of the great pleasures of Marilyn Robinson is it's still possible and likely that you and I have read everything she's written. And, you know, it's like watching an entirely wondrous sensitivity bloom before your eyes. I like to think of the books as going from mystery to dailiness. In the case of Home, I felt like not only were these characters living in my head, I was living with them in their home. And I wondered if we could talk about it. It seems like a spiritual progression from that first book, which is a book of kind of transcendental mystery, to an actual celebration of the pious religious, specifically religious, spirit.
Well, I think that 24 years made a difference in my worldview. I don't think that that can be minimized. I wasn't young when I was writing Housekeeping, but I might as well have been. You know, I had questions that, in a certain sense, were more interesting to me than any possible suggestion of a response to them. Even, you know. I have always thought of writing as being essentially exploratory, and it was intensely exploratory when I was writing Housekeeping, which is, in a way, a result of the fact that I never expected the book to be published, and it really was, in a way, sort of notes to myself.
And as you've proceeded, would you say that these books move along the path of your personal religious explorations?
There's a way in which I would say they are my personal religious explorations. That there's a sort of... in the course of writing anything, there's so much coming back from the page. You know, if I find myself in the place of posing a problem, I hope that it is a real problem, and then the response that I have to it is something that is actually worked out in the prose, which is a great part of the interest for me of writing fiction.
I had... the last time I saw Marilyn Robinson was when Gilead was published, and I had also read her essays in The Death of Adam, and certain aspects of our, what shall we say, national... culture had been so depressing to me that I kind of said to Marilyn, I need to find God, and I need to be restored to some kind of state of grace in whatever religion. I felt the books brought out in me a yearning for something my daily life and my country were no longer providing for me. Do you find people turning to you? Because I felt like saying, Marilyn, bring me to God. Give me.
Well, you know, I think that it's true of a great many people that a very strong religious impulse is just beneath the thinnest sort of surface, and that the way that religious conversation, thought, and so on, or the absence of thought, have developed in the culture in the last, who knows how long, 25 years is a minimum, it's made people embarrassed to claim religious thought because since they're not exposed to it in a deep way, they can't think past what are clearly to them very shallow religious conceptions that are very widely available. I think that, my experience has been that if people see religion in a sympathetic light, however briefly or in whatever form, they feel a very strong attraction to it in many cases, you know. There's a strange way in which culture can falsify itself. And, you know, any poll will say that Americans are overwhelmingly religious, and yet they have, I think, a pretty overwhelming anxiety simply because they feel as if religion is so volatile and so easily tilted toward exclusivism or judgmentalism or things that, frankly, they reject on religious grounds.
It seemed to me that Housekeeping some of its cadences, particularly the beauty of that trip on the lake where crystal is discovered, that I felt the presence of Emerson. And it seems to me that we live in a country that once married the rhythms of our literature and the cadences of our best sermons. And I wondered if you feel that way in the writing of your fiction, because like a great sermon, the appreciation of aspects of the world, small and large, become tiny models for a kind of exaltation and grace in these books.
Well, thank you. There's nothing in the world I admire more than a good sermon. I do think, I mean, it's certainly true that Emerson and apparently Melville, Melville preached to his own family and so on, you know, he did. That's a very potent form in American traditional culture, no question about it. And it's a very useful form. It's very rigorous, you know. And it's something where you have to, in a way, enlist and advance a shared understanding with a self-selecting group who come to hear those ideas, hear rigorous ideas, and feel comforted and discomforted by them, you know. I admire Emerson very much. I've probably read him as often as I've read anybody. And Thoreau, I like all the 19th century writers. And one of the things that has American writers, I'm speaking of that specific group that I think is misnamed transcendentalists. But in any case, they were great, you know, and the accident of their being American and the accident of their being 19th century and having their portraits put on school walls and so on, it's made us sort of treat them as relics when in fact they're as important thinkers as their great contemporaries, you know, people that are still treated as serious philosophic minds in other contexts.
Well, you know, when I moved here, well, everyone was warning me that I wasn't going to like it here. In fact, they would say, you're going to hate it. But I wanted, you know, if you live in a place, you want it to instruct you. So I started going to various, you know, spiritual New Age meetings and movements and channelers and what have you, including I took a class and I discovered, oh, this is Emerson. This is Emerson. It's literally so. And once you discover it, you discover that Emerson is like an instruction manual for the exploration of the soul and returning the soul to God and, you know, seeing God in the fragments of things around you, the glitter of mica. And, you know, the excitement of discovering that literature was not just there to, you know, rough me up with, you know, with right. difficulty in spirit, but really meant to take my hand and instruct me in the exploration of the intersection of the spiritual world with the physical world. What an amazing thing.
However painful, there's always an enormous energy of celebration behind Melville, behind all of these people. Just, it's as if that because of the way that their religious sensibility is saturated with sensory experience, basically, you know, the real world as it appears to us. There's a way in which everything is converted into, you know, a spectacular demonstration of divine intent, you know. And that's very beautiful, and it operates on the scale of some, you know, of Kant or someone, you know, except it's really beautiful.
Well, you know, whenever people bring in Kant, If you'll pardon me, I think of something because, you know, I was very frightened of it. And, you know, in our culture, I have the feeling that a good many of us, even the most intelligent of us, are frightened by the difficulties of our own divines, our own philosophers, our poets, our writers. And I do believe that one of the great things of literature is wandering unballasted into the unknown. And the poet Randall Jarrell said about reading Kant's Critique of Judgment, he said, "I loved it. It was like Midsummer Night's Dream."
Well, sometimes I have to wonder. I love the sense of receiving things historically, you know, even if they're not my things to receive, you know, like Sufi poetry or something. Just the idea of human fidelity to certain beautiful ideas, or, you know, the fact that when you are moved by a thought that someone thought 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago, there's a sort of human bond that passes through time and really feels as close and authentic as any bond that you have with any actual contemporary. And then just the, you know, some feeling of loyalty I have toward the fact that for all the troubles of history, people have done some spectacular things with their minds, with their perceptions over time, and to receive it in the way that they would have wished you to. It seems to me to be a way of honoring their humanity and honoring your own humanity and so on. I think that we are artificially alienated from anything that we can define as a past, really. And that this is a great impoverishment, you know, just because there is so much value, so much to be seen, so much that's moving in what people have done over time. And it's as if you're doing something eccentric if you look back, you know, look back at the human confession or testimony.
I'm curious, because this is an exploration that has just begun relatively since I've read Gilead. I've been reading Martin Luther, as I know you had, and I'm curious because that's, well, like the Reverend Ames's many, many sermons in the Abbey.
Yes.
That's an enormous amount of writing. And I'm curious, I brought up the Jules Renard, "No matter how much care you take to write as little as possible," while thinking of Martin Luther. Do, in reading the work of a religious visionary, do you feel in this case to read the complete work?
Oh, there is not time enough. One of the things that is absolutely characteristic of the great theologians, Thomas and Augustine and Luther and Calvin and Karl Barth, they never stop writing. You think, how many volumes could one mind contain? And you know, you dip in at any place and it's wonderful and it's interesting, but to be exhaustive, I think, would, you know, you'd have to devote your life. But one of the things that I like very much about theology and about the history of it is that it's never satisfied with itself. You know, every great theologian exists to be moved beyond. And so you see these very complex ideas working themselves out over time, you know. And with all kinds of, I mean, Luther is so passionate, you know, and Calvin is so, you know, trying to be temperate and so on, you know, and there's so much emotional burden as well as intellectual brilliance in these writers.
Well, the relief, you see, because fiction has a tendency to disguise some of its intellection in its drama and in the beauty of its details, but to be reminded that, you know, the mind needs to go step by step in order to know anything, and that to leave out the steps. It seems to me that in this way, a novel can be like an argument. You know, very, very gradual, and that to read too quickly is to misperceive the nature of the gradualness of its composition. And it seems to me that your composition in particular is so detailed in its recognitions of what comes first that a critic or two has claimed that some of the arguments between a father and son in Home are repetitious. But as I read them, I understood, no, you don't understand. The ground has been reset each time. There's a new stage of learning here, and the result is always different. So I wondered about that working of detail.
I think that, I am dependent on, as I say to myself, keeping my characters in front of my eyes. If I have to see the scene in my imagination, and there can't be jumps within the scene. You know, I can't hurry. Because in order to do the conjuration that's necessary for me to maintain my faith in the truth of what I'm lying about, I have to keep the integrity of it by seeing it in detail, really.
Now, because it would be a great shame for you not to hear Marilyn Robinson's reading voice, I've asked her, although this is a conversation, to read a section of Home. I'll quickly sketch the situation for those of you who have either not read Gilead or haven't looked at Home yet. A son, Jack, has come back home after 20 years. His sister, Glory, is there. They are taking care of their father, Robert Boughton, who is, like Reverend Ames, in his final stages. And in this scene, they are preparing to dress their father. They are dressing their father for dinner.
Jack came downstairs to help prepare their father for his dinner, wordlessly, since the old man slept on in the vapors and perfumes of Sabbath. He polished the old man's shoes and brushed his jacket and rummaged through his ties. He brought out two, one a dark blue stripe and one maroon and ruby. Glory touched the gorgeous one. Jack nodded and draped it over the shoulder of the jacket. Then he rummaged again and found the tie clasp that looked like a dagger with a St. Andrew's cross on the hilt and the matching cufflinks. She shrugged. Allusions to Scotland aroused in their father a wistful indignation and a readiness to defend the proposition that history in general ought to have unfolded otherwise, with that one sad instance as case in point. Ames, being no Scot, nor much interested in history after the sack of Rome and before the Continental Congress, heard him out with a patience their father found trying. "Then what does matter?" their father would ask the heir once Ames was out the door. So Jack returned them to the dresser. He came back with the Masonic set, Scottish rite, of course, but a reminder of power and prosperity won despite all. Ames was no Mason either, so their father's vows of secrecy forbade conversational forays that might otherwise have become tedious. She nodded. She brought out his best new shirt. Jack touched the sleeve and whispered, "Very nice." Their father had always said it was a false economy to buy clothes of poor quality because he was, in his decorous ministerial way, a dandy. From time to time in their childhood, boxes arrived from Chicago. Suits and shirts and ties emerged from them, ordinary enough to pass unnoticed, except as they gave his lanky body an air of composure and grace. A new dress or suit, which also arrived from Chicago, was the reward for the child who gained the most height as a percentage of his or her height the previous Easter. This began as a ploy of their mothers to get them to eat vegetables. The figuring of percentages was added as a concession to Teddy's notions of equity. It was he who reflected on the fact that the girls would be sure to grow less than the boys did in absolute terms. Jack never turned up for the measuring ceremony, which was a boisterous business of cake and cocoa and argumentative calculation. But that one year, the suit was for him anyway, and he did come to Easter service, looking so beautiful, his father said, when he mentioned it. So she and Jack made a sort of piecemeal simulacrum of their dozing father. Jack played solitaire beside him while Glory dressed, then Jack went upstairs while Glory finished the vegetables and the gravy. Half an hour before the Ameses were to arrive, Glory roused her father and helped him into his clothes, washed his face and brushed his hair into a fine white tassel that went handsomely with his glorious tie and the irascible look he assumed to conceal his pleasure at these attentions to his vanity. "Jack is here," he said, as if to exclude other possibilities. "He went upstairs a few minutes ago. He will be back downstairs in time for dinner." "Yes." Then Ames arrived with Lila and Robbie and the three of them in their church clothes, and she took her father into the parlor with them, the company parlor, where they sat on the creaky chairs no one ever sat on. It had been almost forgotten that they were not just there to be dismally ornamental, chairs only in the same sense that the lampstand was a shepherdess. Ames was clearly bemused by the formality her father had willed upon the occasion. The room was filled with those things that seem to exist so that children can be forbidden to touch them, porcelain windmills and pagodas and china dogs. And Robbie's eyes were bright with suppressed attraction to them. He leaned at his mother's knee, lifting his face to whisper to her now and then, bunching and twisting the hem of her dress in his hands. There were remarks on the weather. Her father said, "Egypt will have consequences." And she went into the kitchen to sauté the morels, since Jack had still not appeared. Just when his absence began to seem conspicuous and awkward, when she had gone into the parlor to tell them that Jack would certainly be down in a minute or two, they heard him on the stairs, and then there he was, standing in the doorway. He was dressed in one of his father's fine old dark suits. There was a silence of surprise. He brushed at his shoulder. He said, "The cloth is a little faded. It looks like dust." Then no one spoke until his father said, "I was quite a tall fellow at one time." Jack was wearing one of the creamy shirts she had brought down from the chest in the attic and the blue striped tie, and his hair was parted high and combed straight to the side. He looked very like his father in his prime, except for the marked weariness of his face, his mild and uninnocent expression. Aware of the silence, he smiled and touched the scar beneath his eye. But he would have looked elegant after a decorous and outmoded fashion if he had not been Jack, and if they had not thought, therefore, what does this mean? What might he do next? And there was something moving in the fact that the suit fit him almost perfectly, or would have if he were not quite so thin. He was the measure of the failure of his father's body and also perhaps a portending of the failure of his own. Ames said, "Well," and looked at him for a moment before he remembered to rise. Glory had noticed that men who were on uncertain terms with each other will take one step forward, leaning into a space between them as if the distance had been arrived at by treaty and could be breached only for the moment it took them to shake hands. "Jack," he said. Jack said, "Reverend, Mrs. Ames." And then he laughed and smoothed his lapels and looked at Glory sidelong as if to say, "Another bad idea." He was wearing the dagger tie clasp. The brightness in his face meant anxiety. When he was anxious, a strange honesty overtook him. He did understandable things for understandable reasons, answering expectation in terms that were startlingly literal, as if in him the skeletal machinery of conventional behavior, the extension and contraction of the pulleys of muscle and sinew, was all exposed. And he was aware of this, embarrassed by it, inclined to pass it off if he could as irony, to the irritation of acquaintances and strangers, and she could only imagine employers and police.
Now, as I was listening to the passage, there are certain moments and words that seem to proceed through this novel. Jack is always touching a wound under his eye. That's a physical gesture, but seems to have, as it plays, something that becomes more and more moving about vision and a possible wound to vision at a part of his life. And then there's, you use the phrase, the silence of surprise, but every kind of silence plays through this novel, particularly I think of the passage in which the point of view character, Glory, speaks of sometimes, though rarely, when she would teach, arriving at a point where there was a silence beyond silence, the silence of incomprehension, but then the silence of something deeper, the silence of students coming to understand something. And reaching the point beyond silence seems to be the goal of some of the scenes in this novel, just as getting beyond defective vision seems to be the goal of the characters. And I wondered if you could talk about the play of leitmotifs and thematics in the book.
When my experience when I'm writing is that in the growth of the fiction, certain things become sort of terms for the conceptions that I'm working with in the fiction. And they are things like silence and a scar and so on. And it, I don't know why it happens, how it happens, but these things take on a sort of coloration for me that does change as they are repeated, but I can in a certain sense recruit them, invoke them for the purposes of giving a certain kind of valence to a scene, you know, put them in different kinds of combinations. It sounds very mechanistic. It doesn't feel like that at all. But I do think that when you're writing a poem or work of fiction, there is a tendency to be creating what is a conceptual vocabulary. And, you know, it is like leitmotif. It's exactly the same idea that repetitions, structured repetitions with variation can, you know, build a composition that has a kind of meaning and wholeness it wouldn't have otherwise. I like very much what you said about silence, and I think that probably this is writerly of me. I think that there must be something beyond words. As a matter of fact, it seems to me as if I'm trying to use words to access what is beyond words, that this is a kind of continuous state of being. And in a way, a state of being that I would consider ideal, you know?
Right. Well, I think so too, although I know that there are some, you know, let me rephrase. It was once said about the difference between French surrealism, which was reflected in New York poetry, and Spanish surrealism, which was reflected in Midwestern poetry, that the difference was between the quest to render the interior of silent objects, and that was the Spanish tradition, and the attempt to render their surface as if the surface were incomprehensible. And Midwestern surrealism was characterized by the attempt to find the language of stones and other silent things. Stones, bones, feathers appeared in the poetry of Robert Bly, of James Wright, of many of the great Midwestern poets. And I do think that when people say, I don't get it, why would you write to achieve silence? But it's as if words are conduits back down a path that began at silence, and that if you take them properly, you'll arrive at a meditative state that's pre-creation and pre-experience, or at least ideally. I'm curious about the idea of language to arrive at silence.
Yes, well, I think that for me, language is what I have. You know, I mean, I'm sure other people would use painting or music or something in a more perhaps direct way, you know, I mean, a way that's more direct than I can achieve. I think one of the things that I want to do is, de-verbalize experience to a very considerable extent, really. The way that, in fact, you know anyone that you know well, or you can even have strong perceptions about people you don't know well, that can only be diminished by being articulated. That, this is obvious. I mean, I don't think there's anything harder than describing another human being in anything like an adequate way, or describing anything that's been saturated with human presence and intention, you know. And that, one of the things that I really do think that I try to avoid when I'm writing is that we have created a lot of shorthand that is supposed to basically describe things adequately, sum things up. And it really is completely inadequate to the real experience, frankly, of life, to the real sense of other presences, to the real definition of motive or desire. In a way, I'm sort of pushing my characters toward an apprehension of one another that is not diagnostic, you know, or judgmental in any of the pretty impoverished terms that are available to us.
I want to all ask you to understand that I understand, and I think Marilyn Robinson understands, that if you look at the way we're talking now as being crazy, you're not wrong, but you aren't right. And that the presence of insane dialogue about silence would be, to our minds, and I think the minds of many in the room, of great value to the culture we're living in, that we don't hear in our daily lives talk that doesn't have a goal, that doesn't know where it's trying to get, that stumbles and needs all the beautiful words at its disposal simply as a banister, you know, as a way of having something to lean on in the hope of getting to something perhaps permanent. I noticed about this book that you were speaking of character and intention, that whereas other novelists work to strip away the layers and expose a character's secrets, that in this book, what you're looking at is the way the characters guard and maintain their privacy, that there's no interest in stripping them down, but rather in seeing what frail things allow them to protect themselves.
Yes, I think in the same way that I think that language is not adequate to describe other human beings, I think it's also true that something that you cherish, either because it offends your, you know, we hide our wounds, something that you cherish because it's at odds with your pride or your what you wish other people to think of you, or something that you cherish simply because it's a very dear thing that no one else could understand the value of if you were trying to articulate it. Something that would be shamed and reduced by being put in words because of the inadequacy of them. And because of, frankly, anything that you take to heart in the extreme individuality of your own experience is not something that can be conveyed in the terms of its actual value to you, its actual life. And it seems even dangerous to make the attempt. I think that one of the things that we do is, in a certain sense, flatten out our experience by being too forthcoming. And by putting experience that is really very intimate and has its meaning and its beauty as a secret, in effect, becomes pedestrian when it's put into language that's likely to be diagnostic or when you say the dearest thing nearest to your heart and the person that you say it to says, you know, I had that same experience. You know what I mean? You know they didn't. You know they couldn't. There's a certain sense, I think, in which the beauty of individual experience is its profound individuality, which has to be protected, and which I think, I mean, my people in my books protect each other's in that way. Gloria would no more strip down his secrets than she would stab him or something, you know, I mean, because she knows about these things.
I wanted to open the conversation to questions from the audience, but first I wanted to give some applause to Marilyn. Passing among you are attendants, I think, with microphones, and so if you'll raise your hand, one will be brought to you. Yes, I'd be happy to. I'll be glad to. Yes.
You mentioned that Emerson and the other transcendentalists, I'm sure you mean Thoreau and Channing and Alcott, were mislabeled. What name would you call them?
Well, I think that their writing has a great deal more to do with immanence than with transcendence. The idea, you know, the sort of bipolar quality that's suggested by the concept transcendence, I think, is exactly what they were not interested in doing. They were interested in their beans. they were interested in the feltness of life. I mean, a certain, you know, Walt Whitman, what else are they talking about? It's simply that it is not, it's invested with the highest meaning. It's not trivialized by the fact of being reality of a kind that is not normally given that kind of attention.
Yes.
I was so interested in what you just said about how sometimes by being too forthcoming we flatten out our experience. And I was wondering if, as a writer, you see yourself standing kind of in contrast or against writers like Joyce and Faulkner, who make completely bearing human experience and analyzing every little detail of it their mainstay, or if not.
I'm not too crazy about Joyce. Isn't that awful? Please do not chase me from the building. But Faulkner is one, I think, is one of the greatest novelists in the history of the genre. There's a difference, you know. I mean, like when he has Benji speaking at the beginning of The Sound and the Fury, people have an idea of what an quote-unquote idiot is, and they certainly would have had one in the 1920s, you know. But he doesn't describe him. He moves inside him, and he does that, you know, the investing of experience with very high meaning. That, you know, I mean, the ironic title, it's so far from signifying nothing, it signifies everything in the entire volume, you know, and signifies a great deal more beyond that. What I'm basically talking about when I talk about flattening experience is when you have a generalized language of inwardness, and that's, you know, goes back to Freud, and, you know, the idea that in a sense it's sort of like a primitive Model T, you know, where there are standard parts and they can be repaired. And, and if there's a knock in the engine, we know that's a bad thing, you know what I mean? This kind of conception of human individuality, which is such a spectacular phenomenon, what is more impressive? The reduction of it to, to various states of mind that perhaps need to be massaged or medicated or something like that, you know, so that the individual drama, the individual pilgrimage, is unvalued.
Yes.
Hi. Michael Silverblatt, thanks for your work on KCRW. And Ms. Robinson, I have two questions. One is, I'm sorry, I don't know your biography, so I'm wondering when you decided to write. And also, in the book Home, it seemed like Glory's relationship to her fiancé was mirrored in Della's relationship to Jack. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, you know, I never really decided to become a writer. I wrote a book and handed it to a friend who sent it to an agent. And then I found, then I was published, then I was a writer. It was something that sort of happened to me rather than anything I actually... I mean, there are two ways of thinking about being a writer. One of them is that you have words in your head and you want to see how they look on paper. That's me. And then there's the idea of, in a certain sense, making a career, shaping a career, which can be a perfectly fine thing too, you know. But that was, I did not have that conception, and I didn't myself do much in the way of bringing myself to that place. Even when Housekeeping was published and when it was well received, I found it quite sort of confusing, and I didn't want to do anything similar again, which is part of the reason that those 24 years passed. What you're saying is true, that there is a likeness between Jack's relationships with women in general and with Della and Gloria's relationship with the unnamed other. But there are various reasons for that. One of them being, of course, that in the 1950s, the expectation of marriage, especially for women, was extraordinarily high. And, you know, anybody living to that point would have some story to tell of success or failure at that particular enterprise. But the part of the reason for that figure, to my mind, is that it casts light on Jack. The fact that even though, I mean, he's embarrassed to talk about his stint as a dance instructor and all the rest of it, but basically what he's saying is there's a lot of similarity between him and me. And Gloria understands that, and she understands the hurtfulness of it. She understands, you know. And so for her to accept him, for her to forgive him, is a much more meaningful thing, because she has felt in her own nerves what exactly is been passing there. Of course, he loves Della. He's in love with Della, and she is his wife in every sense but the legal sense, you know, and that's a difference.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Michael, you talked a little bit about the beauty and rarity of having a conversation that one doesn't really know where it's going, and I guess there's maybe a parallel with a spiritual or religious yearning. And I'm wondering, in the context of writing, Marilyn, whether you know where it's heading, or do you have any sense? Do you have a banister, or what kind of sense do you have as to where you're headed?
Well, typically I have had as little as possible because I was afraid of my own critical training, and I didn't want to do something that I'd seen somewhere else. But of course I was constrained in writing Home by the ending of Gilead. There wasn't much I could do, having set myself the problem of writing a companion to Gilead. I don't like plot very much. Please try to contain your surprise. But it very often becomes a big machine that drags things after it and leads to the sliding of character and language and a sort of insensitivity to the more interesting implications of the fiction. And so between these two things, I generally don't know where I'm going.
There was someone in the same row there who had his hand or her hand raised. Oh, okay.
Thank you so much for your beautiful literature.
Oh,
I appreciate it. And thank you, Michael. Yes, my question is about the spirit as opposed, or I don't know exactly to say whether it's opposed to the belief in God or the divine, that it seems to me that Glory and her relationship to Jack, as well as his father, his relationship to his son, is extremely spiritual, and that what is the entrance of the need for God beyond that spiritual connection?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that maybe, I mean, I said this to Michael earlier in the day, but I have certain figures in my mind in the characterization of Jack, and one of them is the thief on the cross. The Gospels, there is a narrative of Jesus being crucified between two thieves, and one of the thieves mocks him, and the other thief says, "We're guilty, you know. Don't make fun of the. He's an innocent man." And then Jesus says, "I will see you today in my Father's house," you know. And the classic reading of that, of course, is that the thief recognized Jesus as the Messiah and was therefore, you know. But the way I've come to read the scene, it's as if he's a man who has loved justice. You know what I mean? He's a thief, but in his extreme moment, he's saying, "Don't abuse this man." You know, he's defending someone else. He's defending the innocence of someone else, and it seems to me as if in that moment, if you do a sort of humanist reading of the text, what you're being told is that Jesus found this beautiful, you know, and that is why he responds to the thief in the way that he does, you know, and in that sense, I mean, this seems sort of beside the point of your question, but I think that the idea of what traditional religion has told us about spirituality and so on has been allowed to sort of atrophy, and so that the idea of spirituality as opposed to religion or spirituality as opposed to belief in God has begun to seem like a clearer distinction than in fact for me, or in my opinion, traditionally, it has been, you know? Which is another long way of saying that for me, I've never felt the need for the distinction. I've never really made it.
Yes, right up here. Yes.
Hello. Picking up home after reading Gilead, obviously the first thing that struck me at least is that they take place at the same time. And I'd like to ask you about the setting, the time of the novels, and the passing of generations in this, the way Reverend Ames and Boot Bowden, and then Jack and Glory, and why you chose to write about these preachers at this point in their career in this decade, and beside your theological interest for its own sake, about the history of the history of religion in America as it is in particular in the middle of the post-war years of the United States.
Well, I chose that period in the first place because I was very interested in the history of the Middle West and the abolitionist history, which is really lost and forgotten, and a very valuable passage in American history. And so I wanted my character to be of, you know, set in a period and of an age where he would have had some direct contact with that. And it's the memory of his grandfather, of course, it's tenuous at that, but and then since that's the setting for Gilead, it's necessarily the setting for home also.
Marilyn, I wanted to ask you What was your impetus to return to fiction? What was it as a kind of source for your exploration after writing two books, works of nonfiction, following Housekeeping?
Right. I have no idea. I just have no idea. I was in a hotel room in Massachusetts, and suddenly John Ames was a presence in my mind after all those years. And I was so surprised because I really didn't anticipate a male narrator.
Marilyn, yes. I'm wondering what books you're currently reading.
Oh, well, what I'm doing now, I'm preparing a series of lectures that I'm supposed to give at Yale in the end of March and the beginning of April, four lectures. And one of the things I'm doing, this is so characteristic, I can't even believe it, but I'm in a way sort of reliving my own education to kind of, I'm interested in what we assume and what I assume on the basis of the sort of curriculum of education that has occurred in my lifetime, basically, but for all purposes in the modern and contemporary world, you know. So I've been reading Bertrand Russell and William James and Sigmund Freud and, oh, the list goes on and on. And it's been very, very interesting to do that. I mean, when you look back a little way at someone like Freud or someone like James, people that still have relatively robust reputations and presences, although Sigmund Freud is not quoted anymore, but he left a great deal lying around in the landscape that people assume is true and descriptive, you know. When you look at these things from a little distance, they begin to be estranged, sort of like, you know, like an old empire that has vanished and left its relics, and you think, whoever thought that was a good idea, you know? And so basically that's what I'm doing. I'm using also contemporary writers on the mind, like E.O. Wilson and so on, because there's a very strong tradition that I think needs to be reconsidered, and one that in a way, I mean, my brilliant genius, giant, great theorist of the mind is Wallace Stevens, and I think that probably he will take up a great part of the fourth lecture.
Do we have time for two more questions, Michael?
Yes.
You said that you were in Massachusetts in a hotel room when Reverend Ames came into your mind. What in the book Gilead? What was your first scene that you started writing? That you were. What was the first part of the story that you started with in the very beginning? Was it the beginning, or was it somewhere in the middle?
It was the beginning. The first conception that I had was of an old man sitting at a desk, writing letters to a child that's playing on the floor, and with the idea of addressing him as he imagines him, a grown man. And the thing that is strange about that book is that I wrote it absolutely in sequence. I would write 30 or 40 pages, send it to my editor, write another 30 or 40 pages, and that went right in. The book as we have it now is this serial novel that I was writing. He said he'd never read a novel that way before, and I said, I've never written a novel that way before.
One more.
Hello, Ms. Robinson. Thank you for being here with us.
It's a pleasure.
I want to know when you write and where you write. What is your process, please?
I hate to say it, but, you know, process is just too kind a word. I work in my own house, you know, or in a study in upstate New York. I write obsessively when I have something on my mind. I can go for quite a long time without feeling any impulse to write. If I try to make myself stick to a schedule and produce a certain amount of words or whatever, a day or a week, it's all garbage. And I just have to wait until I don't know what it is, but you get a certain sort of buzz. There's a certain sort of density in your experience of your own thoughts. And that's what I depend on. If I'm engaged in what I'm writing, which I tend to be after I get a novel started. Then I can write almost indefinitely. I can write fill all the time that I can find with writing, and it's has an appropriate level of concentration. But I'm obsessive, or I'm drifting and dreaming. Those are my two states of being.
Thank you very much. Marilyn Robinson will be signing books in the lobby.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.